How are you this evening?
Fine.
Good.
How are you?
Alive. I'd like to talk to you this evening about a couple of things. Of course, I haven't very much to say, but I thought of giving you a lecture entitled Man, Past, Present, and No Future. And then I thought, well, actually, that might be too lugubrious, you know, to talk about man at all. And so I just thought we'd talk about conquered territory. Dianetics, Scientology, and conquered territory. Now, there's hardly anything to put on this except 5 years. And there's been a few things occurred in the last 5 years, and I don't think I've ever given any real summary or rundown on what actually had occurred. But a few things happened. The first moment that Dianetics and Scientology entered the scene as such was really 1949. There'd been a few flurries up to that time of no great moment, but in 1949 things started to happen. In 1947, I wrote a pamphlet for use by the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association entitled Abnormal Dianetics. Today that is known as the original thesis. This was written purely as a summary and rundown of some research and investigation for use by the medical profession. The medical profession did not see why it had to know anything about the mind, didn't doubt that there might be something there in that thesis about the mind. The offices, their main offices in the Middle West, thought that very possibly there very well might be something in the material, but saw no reason why a medical doctor should be interested. And saw nothing they could possibly do with it because they didn't have any department of research and investigation with which to look over new developments. In view of the fact that I've always heard about the American Medical Association's Bureau of Investigation, well, I was rather flabbergasted, but there's a joke here. The Bureau of Investigation only looks over offenses by doctors and non-doctors. And that's their Bureau of Investigation. So they had no way to test the material, and whereas they saw no reason to doubt the fact that a nuclear physicist could possibly come up with some answers regarding human thought, in view of the fact that the entire field of thought had moved over into the sphere of electronic brains and things like this, they saw no reason why there shouldn't be an answer there. They yet could do nothing about it, saw no reason why they should do anything about it. And apathy, apathy, apathy. Well, so I submitted the material to the American Psychiatric Association, and they mailed it around to some of their offices. I was quite startled to find that the American Psychiatric Association is a stock company. It isn't a number of psychiatrists banded together. It's a stock company, and a lot of people own shares in it. And the people are not necessarily psychiatrists. And they have no method of viewing any material about the mind or passing any opinion upon it or have any interest in it at all. That was a great shock to me. I thought the American Psychiatric Association was an association of psychiatrists, and it wasn't a stock company. And as a matter of fact, while I was talking to them in their offices in the East and talked it over with them, one of their salesmen approached me and asked me if I wouldn't like to buy several shares in the organization. So I had one of my pals, always have connections, that's my motto. I had one of my pals down in Wall Street take a quick look around and find out how much it would cost to buy up the controlling interest in the American Psychiatric Association, and found out it would only cost $58,000. Figuring that it was already owned then, and not having $58,000 at the moment, I, by the way, had lost my loaded dice and marked cards and other sources of revenue, we had to let that one go by. So here sat a body of information to whom or where should this body of information be submitted? There must be some place in the land that had some interest in the field of the mind. So I thought, well, there's another organization called the American Psychological Association. Although it's a small organization and so forth, psychology by definition is a subject which does research in the mind. They'd probably be interested in this. So I sent them a lengthy report. I didn't submit the thesis. I merely sent them a lengthy report. And they wrote me back a letter and thanked me very much for the report. And so I said, wrote another letter and asked them if they didn't want to know some more about it. And they were very happy to send me back a postal card acknowledging the receipt of that. And that was death for them, as far as I can understand, because I never got another stir out of them. They had no objection to somebody knowing something or doing something. In fact, they weren't worried or upset in any way about anybody doing any research. But there was no channel. See? No channel. So I then made it my business to find out what the University of Blank did with its information. And it filed it. And I looked around to try to find out what were the channels of communication regarding research and investigation in the field of the humanities, and I discovered there was none. And that was the dawn of Dianetics and Scientology. Up to that time, it hardly even had a name. But in the absence of a channel of communication, there was only one thing which an individual could do if he was able to do anything about the mind. Now, mind you, at the time I really did something active about this, I had been active in the Savannah Medical Center and had treated a number of people there, quite a series of cases, had worked quite extensively and practically with this information, so there was no place to go except to release the information generally. So through 1949, I continued the research and investigation and got into the stage of organization whereby it could be presented to the general public. In other words, a communication line had to be created for the dissemination of any information about the field of the human mind. The last communication line which was created actively of this nature was created by William James in, I think, 1898. And that gave rise, really, was the thing which gave rise. You wrote a book, forgotten the name of the book, some technical name, gave rise to all of these psychology departments you see parked around in the various universities. And that was simply a book addressed to men who had some little learning so they might think about the subject of the mind. And that's the only bump the psychology ever got to amount to anything. So, actually, psychology, for any prominence it had, was created in the same channel. All right. In early 1950, had the manuscript ready. It was published May the 9th. And we're coming right up on that anniversary, May the 9th, 1950. And that book was called Dianetics, Modern Science and Mental Health. The book, however, was preceded by another book. And almost anybody thinks of Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health as being the first book on Dianetics and Scientology. It was not. The first book was this book we now call the Original Thesis, because in its manuscript form, it was being forwarded all over the world by people who were copying it off on typewriters, hectograph, mimeograph. I have seen editions of it, which were the most scrambled mess you ever saw because they were fifth-hand copies. There are people across the world right now that don't know that a single further step was made than that original thesis. And the mail started to arrive as a result of that book. The mail came in heavier and heavier doses, and finally a psychiatric textbook house offered to publish a book on the subject, and that was Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health. But this other book is still kicking around the world. A very short time ago, I heard of it newly. A fellow came in and said, I didn't know there was anything else written, and I was very, very glad to have an additional piece of information on Dianetics. And this book, Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health, is quite an advance over that earlier work you had. I'm glad we have a modern work. 5 years old. Well, all right. Here is just a slight summation. As soon as the book was published, mail volume increased so alarmingly it was necessary to make some kind of an organization. A number of, I suppose, respectable businessmen, representative of various professions, got together and formed a foundation called the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation of Elizabeth, New Jersey. I did not control that organization. I merely had one vote on a board of trustees of seven. The organization continued forward and was eventually sold out by its trustees to a fellow in the Middle West who did not pay the bills of the organizations he said he would do, and who threw the organization in order to get personal ownership of it into bankruptcy and bought it out of the bankruptcy court. Now, that organizationally might have dead-ended right there if 2.5, 3 years ago, with a very good friend and attorney here in Phoenix taking charge of the legal picture and getting it straightened out, that might have dead-ended all organizations on this subject. That would have been that. But organized by that time, more information had developed, organized the Hubbard Association of Scientologists, and that was incorporated in Arizona. And that organization carried on and was really the first organization over which I myself had any control, any real control. Now, that organization has carried on forward. It's changed its name to Hubbard Association Scientologists International, but it is about 3 years old, more or less, and it's been right here in Phoenix. And that organization has gone forward, disseminating information, taking care of, servicing the data on this subject. Now, why is it necessary for an organization to exist? Well, I've just told you there was no communication line for data on the subject of the mind or research and investigation in that field. This is very, very much the case. Anybody who has any data on the subject has to publish it himself, more or less, and this has made a great deal of confusion since nobody has tried to correlate this information. The Hubbard Association Scientologists and the earlier foundation actually tried to coordinate information and in many instances has solicited or taken under its wing data developed independently by people across the country. And where any of this data was of any use whatsoever, it has tried to use that data. It is also given credit for data so developed. There are a couple of books right now in the foundation files that were authored by independent researchers. We were instrumental, for instance, in California in putting out a monograph by a fellow by the name of Bulkley, who had a biographical approach. There was no agreement between Bulkley's work and Dianetics, but we had already formed a communication line. Now, a great many copies of that monograph were released, and whatever the war between Bulkley's theories and Dianetics and so on, that had nothing to do with it. The organization there was perfectly willing to act as a communication line. The information on e-therapy was also shot in to the foundation, was tested and found dangerous, and was blocked, and e-therapy came up on its own independent communication line. Actually, it would have been far better for the organization simply at the time, over the dead bodies of the trustees, as I tried to do at that time, simply publish anything anybody sent in about the human mind. You see, this wide open communication line. Because there was no communication line. Well, that is not a very fascinating background. It merely tells you what happened to organizations. Anything that gets in contact with man is liable to get a little bit chaotic. And they did, more or less, from time to time, get chaotic. But they are straightened out, and these organizations are now all together. The Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation is again in full action and is part of this picture of organizations right here in Phoenix. And the headquarters of these organizations are in Phoenix, and these organizations have representatives now all over the world. The newest office going in for the organization is going into Australia at this moment. Person right here in the audience at this moment instrumental in creating that office. But the organizational picture is one thing. Let's take a look at this communication line. It's very self-centered of us to keep on talking about, well, we did Dianetics, you know, and how wonderful we are, and all that sort of thing. But let's be a little less passionate about the thing, a little less introverted, and let's just take a look at an organization called Man and find out that for all of his vaunted scientific bents, for all of his printing presses, his magazines, for all of his internal organizations, not to have any organized clear channel for data and discoveries of value to man, tells you at once where the ball opened. What kind of a state was man in 1947? That gives you some sort of an estimate, then, how far we have come. No communication. The organizations in charge of healing in the United States, without any department amongst them to evaluate or publish information about healing, regardless of the month. It's fantastic. You mean the American Medical Association cannot furnish its members with any data? That they leave it all up to Abbott and Lilly and Park and Davis, who have, let us say, some commercial interest in what they publish? That the organization really in charge of the healing of all insane and so forth, that this outfit at its highest level might give its mailing list to people who manufacture electric shock machines. You know, so they could disseminate their advertising. No, there we have to take it. We have to look at a society which one way or the other had tumbled along quite a distance without any real planned forward progress. No wonder man here and there is in trouble. No wonder he is sick in some places where he shouldn't be. If no communication line exists in the field of healing, then it must be that vested interests in various things, which are simply financially remunerative, can then foist off upon 2 billion people, which is a fact, any kind of a cocked-up concoction you could name and say, well, this is it. The federal government has the Pure Food and Drug Act, but I'm sure that's mostly to do with what's on the label. Give you an idea of how the Pure Food and Drug Act acts. There's a girl by the name of Lydia Pinkham. And Lydia Lydia was a boon to the human race, there is no doubt about it. But the vegetable compound on investigation by the federal government was discovered to not do anything for anybody. It was kind of a hypnotic thing. If you read enough advertisements why you didn't have this particular trouble, she was worried about it. So the savior of the human race, Lydia Pinkham, was able to put out a compound to the public at considerable cost to the public, which was not in any way beneficial. So the federal government jumped up and down and screamed and took it into court and fined them some vast sum because of their advertising and so forth, and they changed their advertising and went back on the market again and are selling it to this day. They changed the wording in their advertising. That's the totality of effect as far as the federal government is concerned. Well, we do realize that a Pure Food and Drug Act does restrain various wildcat products of one kind or another or misinformation from appearing, but we find it isn't very effective over a very long period of time. In fact, if they investigated a great many of these antibiotics, took it out of the field of opinion where it seems to lie right now, and actually went on a concerted research and investigation of this, then we would have some information about an antibiotic. Man, in other words, was in 1947 sufficiently disorganized so that if he knew anything, there was very little chance of it being relayed to his next door neighbor, unless somebody made a tremendous effort over the dead bodies of a great many vested interests. So that's an interesting state of affairs, isn't it? Very interesting state of affairs. We would say then the society was not in very good shape if scientific information could not be disseminated in an orderly fashion. Now, it's not just information on the mind or healing that was in this condition in 1947. I had a very, very good friend, Robert Heinlein, who was, in addition to being a very good author, is an excellent engineer. Robert Heinlein was at work in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and he had this interesting experience. They got interested sometime during the war in reaction engines. The Russians had been interested in them in 1930, and other people had been interested. But we got interested finally, and sometime during World War II, and we had to know something about this. So there's a thing called orifice pressures, the measurement of orifice pressures. In other words, what size opening do you have in a rocket to accommodate what velocity for the maximum amount of forward thrust? In other words, do we make the hole in the back of a rocket 2 inches? Or do we make it 1 inch? Or do we make it 1/4 inch? And if we made it these various sizes, would it be more efficient? That is to say, would the rocket go further and faster on a smaller amount of fuel? Well, you could see that this is the heart of a reaction engine. All a reaction engine is a nozzle heading that way. Which engine is supposed to drive something that way? That's all there is to it. So if you don't know what size to make this orifice, you don't know anything. 1944-45, Bob Heinlein in the Philadelphia Navy Yard research labs had this amusing experience. He wanted to know if anybody had concocted a table of orifice pressures, which would tell you what size to make the back of the rocket. Had anybody ever calculated this in any way? Because all he could find were some tables made up by fire engine companies. You know, squirting the hose. And these tables were not adequate to drive a big rocket ship or something. I don't know what they were going to do toward the end of the war. Toward the end of wars, general staffs get kind of silly, you know. Even Churchill was getting rather silly. FDR and Churchill and several big wigs, including Eisenhower, I think, had a project toward the end of World War II, which was to float an enormous iceberg of vast size, many square miles of surface, and float that down in through the North Sea and so make a bridge between England and Europe so as to make their invasion. And this was Operation Iceberg, and it's still thoroughly on record. It didn't occur to anybody until after they'd sent out the many scouting expeditions to discover the whereabouts of a suitable iceberg that 7/8 of an iceberg is below water and the channel, the English Channel, is not that deep. You just couldn't have put anything in there that would have supported anything other than that. Well, they get rather silly toward the end of wars, but this sort of capped at this experience that Bob had. He was given this table of fire hose pressures. And so he started riding around all over the country to find somebody who knew something about fire hoses. So he did this, and he couldn't find anybody knew anything more about fire hoses than he already knew. So he decided that maybe there were some independent workers throughout the country that he could get in contact with who really had tested some rockets of various sizes so they could tell him. And so he went looking for the expert, and having the facilities of the research laboratory office and all the secretaries. You know, during war, another funny thing happens. They keep stacking up secretaries. They just keep racking them up, more and more secretaries. You can almost tell, walking into the offices of the military during a war, how long the war has gone on. You just count the number of secretaries they have. And the number of people based at home, that also tells you, too. It gets larger and larger. The same people are out on the front. I mean, that never changes. I mean, they send half a million men out to do the fighting. At the end of the war, the men are still out there, and there's still a half a million. They're still doing the fighting. That's right. But the shore bases get awfully populous. And so he sent these letters all around, and he had this huge battery of secretaries, you see, capable of writing practically everybody in the United States, trying to find an expert on reaction engines. And finally, he got back 5 or 6 very enthusiastic replies from big universities throughout the country, and they said there was such an expert, and his name was Robert Heinlein, and he lived in Philadelphia. This is the state of communication lines. Well, the truth of the matter, although some people might think to the contrary, we have at least laid the groundwork for a scientific communication line in our organizations. Now, it's merely on paper. I mean, it's just there intentionally. But we have then envisioned this in our conquered territory today, that we have seen the lack of an adequate communication line to communicate new scientific information to various parts of the world. And having seen that lack, have actually moved and have really done quite a little discussion on the possibility of an international copyright office, founding one, which would act as a communications crossroads so that an inventor or a research man writing into it could get the proper microfilm copies back on his particular work. But think of the size of this. We at least have seen that there is something necessary, and we at least have a plan of how it's going to be done, and we at least have a couple of personnel who are already, to some slight degree, engaged in doing just this. Now, that's something I've never announced, but we do have this in mind. That's an enormous advance. As advances for man go, that's an enormous advance. Let's take man politically and see how he's advanced politically in the last few years. He got an organization together called the United Nations, and five big powers came in, each one with the power of vetoing the other four. And they said this was going to be something akin to the world government, and this was going to bring peace and stop everything, and the only thing it's done to date is involve everybody in war. They had no plan. Seems like a plan, kind of, is necessary before you go into action. They went into action before they had a plan, and so they don't have peace. So recently we have been subjected to the dust and radiation of some 38 atomic explosions over here a couple hundred miles away. Of course, that isn't dangerous to have a lot of atomic bombs going off. There's really nothing upsetting about all these bombs going off. And if anybody were to learn anything from these bombs, or if these bombs were to serve any purpose, I would be the last one to criticize sending them up. But I've been trying to find out why they've been exploding these bombs, and as near as I can find out, why it's to increase the dust content of the air. And if they did learn anything from exploding these bombs, somebody's going to put it in his sock or in the files, and there it's going to stay. Why? Because somebody doesn't dare open the communication line. If you close a communication line, you head an individual toward slavery, and you head science toward ignorance. Closed communication lines. The most dangerous thing you can have around is a shut communication line. And very long ago, I was processing pre-clear, who, between sessions, had been told not to say anything to a certain person, not even to the auditor, had been told not to say anything about processing to a certain person. And the pre-clear, after that was told to the pre-clear, came back to the session and wouldn't run. Just acted potty. Perfectly capable of running, except for this one thing. Somebody had said, don't say anything. And that was the end of that pre-clear. We slugged through it and got it kind of knocked out because we were just guessing at what had happened, and then did find out what had happened and got the block released. And the moment that the block was released, the pre-clear in the next session ran well and was again intelligent, responsive, didn't have communication lags and so forth. But this pre-clear had somebody stand in front of him and say, you will not say anything about processing to another person. And that's all that had happened. And the pre-clear practically was cycled. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It means a nation is as sane, and man is as sane as his communication lines are open, and he is as crazy as they are closed. So we've been vastly entertained here in Phoenix by 38 atomic bombs which were being blown off, possibly to keep the price of uranium up, or to entertain the news people, or to exercise Marines. Of course, that would be a worthy project. I like Marines, and they ought to have exciting things to do. But where is that information going to go? Supposing they collected vast quantities of information from exploding all these bombs. Where's it going to go? Down deep in somebody's impenetrably tangled file. And somebody interested in studying energy or studying various manifestations of life, who needs data on radiation, if he wrote and begged and pleaded, would probably find out he was the expert. information collected and hidden better never have been collected in the first place. You get the idea? So that if you collect and codify information and then drop a curtain on it, you're heading somebody, and yourself too probably, into a less exalted state, into a lower degradation. This is an inevitable fact. All right, so 1947, it was clearly, obviously evident that communication lines did not exist in the Society for Scientific Information, particularly on the field of the mind. We have at least recognized it, but we've recognized something else, and this becomes part of our conquered territory. We can prove, absolutely, we can prove very conclusively that the only thing wrong with anybody, anywhere, only we can prove this, we're not just talking about theory, is those pieces of communication which he dare not hand out in any direction. And we can talk about his censor, and we can talk about his sexual experiences at the age of 2, and we can talk about this and talk about that, and specialize this thing of a cut communication, and maybe we'd make a little bit of sense, you know, as much sense as Freudian analysis made. But in order to study the whole subject of the mind, of thought, and of information in general, the only thing you really have to know is that a cut communication line is dynamite. And it's going to blow somebody up somewhere. And we don't know that the atom bomb will ever destroy human life again. But we do know that hiding information concerning atomics is going to blow somebody up somewhere, sometime. This we can absolutely guarantee. In terms of human life, two people who did a despicable thing, a stupid thing, were electrocuted recently just because information about atomic bombs was so secret. They were spies for Russia and handed the information on through to Russia. Well, they had covertly passed a communication, you see, which was supposed to remain secret. Yet here are two people dead. We don't cry over them. They should be dead. But how many more? How many more will be dead because of the data stuffed into inaccessible files on the subject of science? Let us suppose that in 1910, discoveries were made concerning the mind which would have sweepingly bettered the condition of man, the neurotic, the insane. Supposing in 1910 this had occurred, and then that information was buried. How many men have gone insane and committed suicide, killed others, and kept up crime since that time? Those are all casualties. But it'd be worse than that. Supposing somebody had stepped up in 1920 and had solved some tremendously intricate problem in flight, and then this had become buried. It's an interesting fact. You don't have to follow its mechanics any further. But the discovery of it is not aberrative. But the burying of it is death. That's all that's wrong with anybody. Bury it. Do you know that every engram that's in re-stimulation, every wild and uncontrolled picture which confronts itself out of the mysterious depths of the mind into the face of your preclear is there because immediately before it and immediately after it, there's a cut communication. Now, if you study one of these pictures from that standpoint, they start blowing up. One of the most interesting things you ever saw. All right, we're talking about conquered territory. The conquered territory is the discovery that the suppression of scientific information is the most deadly thing which man can do. That's conquered territory. See, we just know that. We know it, we can prove it. All right. If that is true, then it looks like we would not have to do very much in the society of man to bring up the levels of his culture. What would we have to do to actually increase his culture? Go around and get a lot of new ideas? No. Go around and build things up a little better? Put marble, real marble, instead of slabs of it on the front of office buildings? Would this make a better culture? No. I'm afraid that making a better culture would best be accomplished simply by pulling up some of these dams on the society's communications. A lot of people get very nervous when you say that. You know, there's that experience they had when they were five, and Pop and Mama had a fight, and they went next door and told the neighbors. They know it's not safe to have open communication lines. Somebody fixed them up. But let's take a look at somebody who is bent and twisted by some dreadful illness, and this illness has continued for years and years, and they are miserable, they are unhappy people. They do not have in their surroundings, their environment, anything, it seems, which can help them at all. And we as auditors start working with them, and we discover that they are suffering from what? They're not suffering from a bent bone. They are not suffering from a deposit. They are not suffering from an endocrine failure. None of these things. There's only one thing they're suffering from. Somebody, perhaps even themselves, has cut their communication lines. A line existed, somebody came along and cut it. One of the worst cases of poliomyelitis I ever saw, who had been crippled for a couple of decades, could be solved today. All right, let's talk about another part of this conquered territory. What could we solve in 1950? We knew a great deal. We knew a great deal. We knew, first, that man was aberrated and he could be better. We knew, second, that occasionally he could touch heights that without any absence of processing and so forth, he could not hitherto touch. In other words, we discovered a new state of beingness, which was attainable, maybe, and maybe not for a lot of people. But we could work with this new state of beingness, and we could see that there was some hope for man. And that was the next thing after this datum about no communication lines. See, we discovered there are no communication lines in the field of research and investigation to amount to anything, so we create one. So that conquered some territory. We know that all we have to do is go on creating and supporting such communication lines to bring about a great and widespread freedom and a big upsurge in culture. We know that today more than anything else. But we take an individual, how well could he get? Well, actually, today we don't know how well anybody could get, how good he could get. But we had discovered by 1950, and certainly by 1951, that an individual could be far better than the state called Homo sapiens. We had discovered new capabilities in man. First, though, we had discovered that man was aberrated, in contrast to the fact that he could be a little bit better off than he was. See? Here was not even an optimum condition. Here was just a better condition that was easy for an individual to reach. He could just know a little bit more about his mind and himself, and he was a little bit better off than he had been. So, in view of the fact he could be a little bit better off, part of the conquered territory was the discovery that man was aberrated. You see that? Just if you found out he could be better, he certainly wasn't then in an optimum condition. So this became conquered territory too. Then man didn't have to be that way. That was another piece of territory. You know, he didn't have to be aberrated. He didn't have to be in this condition he was in. All right, clear on up now, in today, the processes which we use today are the processes of communication. And all they do, really, is unblock the individual's communication lines and his ability to communicate and his liking for communication. And today, we can sufficiently increase an individual's capabilities to this degree. Talk about conquered territory. Huh. The last many cases who have been audited by staff auditors in the HASI have risen many, many points in IQ. It's an interesting thing that psychology holds as one of its truths, one of its great truths. It holds a truth, by the way. It hides one. Can't. It holds as its great truth that no IQ can change. If you're dumb, you're dumb, and that's it. That's the way it's got things mapped out. And every week, we take a number of people and we shoot their IQs up, not the allowable 4 points of variation. You know, when their people are taking intelligence tests, sometimes they haven't had any breakfast, and sometimes the room is noisy, and sometimes they've just had a fight or been divorced or some other minor thing has occurred to them. And it upsets their ability to take a test. And this will vary their IQ about 4 points. So 4 points doesn't count. Doesn't count at all. We have to get up to 5 and 6 points before we even vaguely move into significance. And we have been rather uniformly changing cases 10, 14, 18 points in 25 hours of processing. Oh, no, this can't be done. I mean, this is impossible. Well, it means that man has evidently been dumber than he had to be. It isn't that we're so hot, but it must mean that part of our knowledge is that man is being stupider than he has to be. If we can come along and take him by the nape of the neck and kick him upstairs in his intelligence quotient, then that means that he can be brighter. And part of our conquered territory is that fact. Man doesn't have to be that dumb. All right. I don't say that every case we process for 25 hours immediately shoots up. No, this is a very truthful report. In the last 2 or 3 months, I think we have had 2 notable cases which did a slight slump in IQ after 25 hours of processing. That was because they didn't have enough processing. That was the main reason. They actually went their 25 hours, and in each one of these cases, we said, please don't leave the area. Please get some more auditing. We will give you some more auditing. We will do something about this. And both of these cases went off to the far horizons. But nevertheless, they're on our records, and we're stuck with them. But those 2 cases are in the middle of an enormous number of cases which did increase. You see, the percentage is the kind of percentage you'd expect unless you expect perfection all the time, and that's pretty hard to attain. So we have had 2 people whose IQ reduced slightly, and both of those people did not have enough processing and were asked to have some more processing for various reasons. One of them, I think, was in pretty bad shape during the intensive. His IQ dropped. Well, it just proves the point if there's an exception to it. We have this interesting fact then occurring right here in Phoenix, a thing which has been considered absolutely impossible for the last 100 years is being done every week in Phoenix. We're taking people's IQ and putting it up. Now, what does 15 points of IQ mean? Well, let's take somebody with an IQ of 74, 76. 15 points of IQ is the difference between this individual looking at you and saying, huh, and giving you an intelligent answer to your question. That's the difference. 70 in IQ is normally somewhere around moron. Although I don't know who started calling these people morons. It's supposed to be absolutely impossible to do anything about the IQ of a moron, but we're pushing them right up the line, too. We have yet to audit, process an individual with that IQ level that we didn't increase. Our failures have been in the upper brackets, if I have my information straight. Well, now, this is pretty good. Means you might even get an army general up to a point where he'd be rational. I mean, anything can happen. All right. That's conquered territory, then. We demonstrate conclusively with the tests of psychology, under the rigors of testing developed by in the field of psychology, that man can be brighter and that the individual man can be much brighter than he is. We don't say at the same time that it's absolutely necessary everybody gets bright. We might even develop a process which could make you stupid, too. You know, if you're too bright and you're being victimized by it all the time, they've got you on the staff of a big organization, and they keep shoving tough problems at you, and they won't let you go, and they have irons around your ankles, you're chained to the wall, you know, that kind of a job. And you get in an economic whirl cage whereby you don't dare quit because you have to have that $200 a week, or that $75, or that $25 a week that they're paying geniuses. If it's true that you had to be more stupid, we could even fix you up so you could be more stupid. But that's beside the point. The main game, and part of the conquered territory, is this: that it will. You could make somebody smarter or dumber. Now, the only thing wrong with the two people that got dumber is we intended to make them smarter. See why that's a boo-boo? That's the only reason it is a boo-boo. If we'd intended to make them dumber, those two cases, that'd be a big success. You know, it's impossible to make people more stupid, according to science in the past. It's impossible. Impossible to make them more stupid. It's impossible to make them brighter. So actually, if they go out with this theory, then it doesn't matter what they do to you. Does it? Doesn't matter? Your IQ is going to stay the same? Well, now, we don't actually care whether your IQ gets up or down. This is just part of our conquered territory. We're doing something that nobody believed could happen. Only we're doing it, and it's quite believable. This is remarkable. We're doing this, and we have demonstrated conclusively. We don't really care whether people are smarter or dumber as long as they're happy about it. But then we do care. You see, if a person's not relaxed about being smart or not relaxed about being stupid, why, then he's going to make quite a commotion. By the way, some of these convictions on brilliance is one of the greatest things that we have discovered. We have discovered that very often the brightest sounding person is pretty dumb. I've run into a fellow who couldn't add 2 + 2 who would tell me by the hour he was the most brilliant man on earth. Only they're crazy. You're not of that category, if that worries you. They really think they're very clever when they're very stupid. And vice versa. I know many brilliant people who are convinced that they're kind of stupid. Well, the actual IQ then isn't the total story. And our next piece of conquered territory is of considerable interest to us. Whether we could raise IQ or not, we could make somebody happy about having it where it was. That's quite a game. That's quite a game. The usual thing for man back before 1947 was to convince him he was stupid and then hang it on him so he was unhappy about it, too. It was not just good enough for him to be dumb, he also had to be unhappily dumb. And quite commonly, if an individual were very bright, or if he were somewhat above average in brilliance, they would hang this on him, too. I well remember a student walking in to an office in a university to report to a dean and being berated soundly for not doing well in his work. His intelligence quotient, it said right there in the dean's desk, was some phenomenal intelligence quotient, and the individual was constantly and continually getting failures in his various subjects, which meant to the dean not that the fellow was smart and tired, but that he was smart and unwilling. And the truth of the matter was, the individual was very, very smart and tired all the time, in a constant state of exhaustion. He couldn't study, and so he kept failing. If he really made any progress at all, it's because he'd dream up the subject just in time to write it down on the examination. So it's how bright a person is or how dumb he is, it's not a real picture. It's how happy he is about it or the other factors connected with it. Well, are these factors alterable? Does a person have to be dumb all of his life? We've already answered that. No. But quite aside from that, does a person have to be tired all the time? No. Does he have to be nervously upset all the time? No. Does he have to be worried about everybody being against him? No. None of these things have to exist. For where it comes to exaggeration of some trait, let's say an exaggerated worry, boy, in Dianetics and Scientology today, we can really do something about that. We can just cut it back to size. In other words, where a tendency is very, very marked and very exaggerated in an individual with whom you can still communicate, let me qualify it to that degree. When you have, you know, he's worried all the time about snakes. You know, he says, every place I go, I open up and snakes, and I think of crossing the pavement, and I think, well, I better not put my feet down off the curb because there's probably snakes in the gutter. Right? Oh, that's right. A lot of people go, that's average. That's routine. Don't be surprised about it. Only they don't talk about it. That's why they are that way about it. The idea? And, you know, they'd be practically well if they could go around. And they're trying to cross the street same time you're crossing the street. And if they could feel perfectly free to turn around to you and say, you know, I have the damnedest sensation here, stranger. Every time I start to step off the curb here, I feel like there's a boa constrictor going to wrap himself around my left ankle. And if the society was so composed that you'd say, well, what do you know about that? He wouldn't have that aberration. So that's conquered territory, too. If you talk about it, it disappears. Well, how does this tie in on earlier psychotherapies? Wherever a psychotherapy has existed, the release of the hidden incident has been the main stress of that psychotherapy. Freudian analysis. Now, it's quite amazing that we took some of Freud's conquered territory and went forward with it. Only we didn't take that territory and develop on it in order to get where we got. We suddenly found where we coordinated with Freud's material. Different thing. And we find, very interestingly, that his idea that if you could make somebody talk long enough, and constantly enough, sooner or later, something would flip into sight and the individual would get well. That idea is tenable, but not very workable, but it's tenable. You could assume that this was the case. He was looking for a peculiar kind of idea, and he expected its release to produce a certain type of reaction in the individual. And then he says, 50% of the human race we can do nothing for. Just, you know, he says, we're trying to do this, then we don't do it, and it takes years of talk by somebody to accomplish this. Well, all he was trying to do was what? Release a pinned down communication line someplace. And if he hadn't been so obsessed that he kept talking about sex all the time, because those are not the only pinned down communication lines. You know, that I bet nobody here has told anybody that he didn't eat with tonight what he had for dinner. I'll bet you that a lot of the people here have some strange ideas about food they've never commented upon to their good friends. You know? And I'll bet you hardly anybody here has not been at a dinner when he failed to state to the hostess, boy, this is horrible, chow. So, if we add up all these suppressed communication lines, one right after the other, we discover that it isn't just the field of sex that is in trouble. We discover that we have a great many fields of human endeavor, and then in any one of those fields of human endeavor, a pinned down communication, a shut communication line, can bring about an aberration. What is an aberration then? It's just something that isn't permitted to communicate. That's an aberration. Of course, that's a pretty gross idea, because we've all got aberrations on that basis, haven't we? And a total communication line to everything in this universe is an unimaginably high goal. But a willingness to communicate to anything in this universe and sanity or capability are synonymous. What is sanity then? It's willingness to communicate. Well, then how sane is a government that refuses absolutely to communicate with 50% of the governments of Earth? Now, can you yourself sit down and state absolutely and with great truth that you would refuse to communicate with 50% of the people you were aware existed? Supposing you just said, I can't, I won't, it is impossible, and under no circumstances am I going to communicate with 50% of the people with whom I have some acquaintance. And suppose you were so mad dog that if any friend of yours did, you'd practically shoot him. Would you be sane? Then we got some new conquered territory. We know how sane a government is. Well, that's how sane a government is. Why would there be a war? How could a war come about? It's by overtly cutting the communication lines between nations and peoples, so that a national boundary enforced with violence would bring about, inevitably, at some future date, a war. How do you create war? You create a barrier across which there must be no communication. So that really is conquered territory, isn't it? If we were really sincere on the subject of no war for man from here on, all we would have to do is say, then the national boundaries of Earth must go. But that would be an adventurous statement. It would be a treasonable statement. If you made it in England, it would be against England. If you made it in the U.S., it would be against the U.S. If you made it in China, it would be against China. In Russia, against Russia. Wouldn't it? Well, if this crime is the crime that can be done in common to all the nations of Earth, doesn't look to me like it's in the field of crime. Must be in the field of psychosis. Must be. I don't say that we should freely lift our gates and let all those poisonous Chinese come in. We're weak white people. We couldn't possibly cope with some yellow people. Yet when I was a kid, I lived with yellow people. I've known a lot of them in this country, and I didn't find them getting in anybody's road. Known a lot of white people, too. Known a lot of white people abroad, didn't find them doing anything horrible to the nations abroad. As countries fall away from a willingness to communicate with other nations and other races, and as peoples fall away from a tolerance of other peoples, so they fall toward the cataclysm known as war. Conquered territory includes the datum, whether useful or not, workable or not, that war comes directly from enforced breaking of communication with various nations and peoples. We know that. We can demonstrate it, prove it. And unfortunately, there are few too many bayonets and opinions, parliaments and Reichstags and other things that would say, you mean to tell me you're not going to let our immigration men play tag with the immigration men of other countries anymore? You mean to tell us that you're going to say that the immigration barriers are the chief thing responsible for hate and intolerance amongst men? And you're going to ask us to do away with this tremendous revenue? Do you realize that we get $30,000 or $40,000 a year from passport visas? And a war costs $30,000 or $40,000 a second. Well, you can't make us do away with that. Well, maybe by force of reason, you could make them do away with it. Conquered territory includes actually a workable within those limits method of bringing peace to Earth. Well, amongst all the conquered territory of Dianetics and Scientology is the principal aberration and its cure. The restoration today of communication lines which have been broken in the past do not include the plumbing of the past, the soul-searching, the researching into the exact modus operandi of existence and secrets of the individual. What do you know? Processors are so good today that you don't even have to be specific about what you're processing, but quite on the contrary, if you get very specific about what you're processing, the processors fail. All right, so that these broken communication lines don't have to be searched for by some painstaking, I don't know, how long is it that an analyst was supposed to be trained if he was a psychiatrist? Was it 28 years or 28 decades or something like that to get him into a state where he could probe somebody's temples with an electric shock machine or a knitting needle, as they use in the prefrontal lobotomy? Dramatizing psychiatry. All right. If we have then a great many things, we also should have the single button in our hands, shouldn't we, that would unlock any and all of the sealed doors of the mind. Now, maybe this button is far too powerful to be applied. But part of our conquered territory includes tonight the identity of this button. Now, there are many buttons. There are many ways communications could be broken. But the chief button in neurosis, psychosis, and sanity is this: communication is bad. And if you get somebody over this idea, you've gotten him over insanity. Communication is bad. He had to say this before he fell away from it. He had to decide that communication was bad before he would consent to stop any of it. He had to say communication was bad before he would damn all of it up in himself or permit it to be damned up in others. This he had to declare to himself: communication is bad. He had to evaluate in this direction before he could become neurotic. We have a button then, and it sits above all other buttons. It doesn't sit above all buttons as far as nomenclature or knowingness is concerned, because knowledge itself is higher than it is. But immediately below knowledge is communication. And communication is immediately above universes, matter, time. It is senior to these things, and its use solves them. So this is a very important thing to know. But an individual had to, someplace, make one postulate in order for things to go wrong with him. And nothing could have gone wrong with him unless he made that postulate. So it is not very useful to an auditor, because by handling it as a bad postulate directly, he would find the whole case collapsing, perhaps, but nevertheless, it has been identified, and that postulate is communication is bad. When an individual decided that communication was bad, he decided simultaneously to abstain from the only cure for aberration, communication. When he decided no longer to talk to somebody, he decided at that moment to be aberrated by that person. Cute, huh? Communication is bad. All right, so we have a great deal of conquered territory. We have a great deal of material. We have a great many books. We have an organization which, in the next few days, will be housed in much better quarters than it has enjoyed before. We have many things. But the best things we have are the know-hows amongst life and with which we could do things with life. And when we have that conquered territory, then Lord knows how much more territory we'll conquer. I'll leave that to your imaginations. Thank you very much.